To get started, so
okay.
Thank you very much.
Thank you.
Does anyone have a calendar?
Calendar?
I don't know what I did with
it.
Good number. So, what is our ADU thing?
Or is she?
Yeah. Not so much. Good afternoon. Welcome to the afternoon 2 o'clock session of the Portland City Council. It's Wednesday, January 6, 2010, and the council will come to order. Carla, can you please call the roll?
Fritz.
Here.
Fish.
Here.
Saltzman.
Here.
Leonard.
Here.
Adams.
Here. We have one item on the agenda today, but it's an item with a lot of facets and details, so it likely will take the full 90-minute requested, and so I ask everyone's forbearance and patience as we learn of it. There is no vote today. This is only a first reading. So, Carla, can you please read the title to item number 54?
Improve Land Use Regulations through the Regulatory Improvement Code Amendment Package 5.
All right. Eric Enstrom is here to provide us with an overview.
Sorry, I'm just making sure I have my notes here.
And then we have some amendments as well.
Here we go.
Good
afternoon. My name is Eric Engstrom. I'm here representing the Bureau of Planning and Sustainability. There are a number of staff from PDOT, BDS, and the Bureau of Planning and Sustainability here to help me answer questions as we go through this. I'd like to start by just saying that we're here to talk about RECAP, the Regulatory Improvement Code Package. This is the fifth time we've brought a RECAP package to the City Council. It's the process of continually improving the city's regulations, particularly those that deal with development and development-related issues. This is the first package that's been brought to you since the Bureau of Planning merged with the Office of Sustainability. And so this, I want to highlight that this package really represents a collaboration between the former two halves of our Bureau and was very helpful in helping us integrate as a Bureau, brought together both the technical expertise of the OSD staff with the implementing expertise of the Planning Bureau. And so with that introduction, we'll just try and be very brief with my description of what's in this package. As you know, RECAPs have a lot of different miscellaneous issues, so I'm going to highlight the ones that we think rise to the top in terms of public interest, but I'll also be prepared to answer questions about other things that I don't cover if it comes up in testimony. So, as I said, the regulatory improvement process is an annual cycle of amendments to the city's codes. It's been in place in this form since 2002. We were here, I think, with RECAP 4 about a year ago. The focus of the program is to deal with technical and minor policy amendments to city codes, and which are distinct from the more major policy changes that you might see either through something like the Portland Plan or a more topic-specific project like the River Plan or the Tree Project, where we're really getting much deeper into a specific issue. So again, these are minor policy amendments and a lot of technical amendments. That said, we do try and bundle together similar issues, and this time is no exception. There's a couple bundles of related code amendments that I'll describe here before we get into this. One is a green bundle related to incorporating and facilitating green building technology and small-scale green energy improvements, better facilitating that in the codes. Another relates to follow-up from the courtyard housing contest that was sponsored by the city in recent years. Another relates to fence height another to loading spaces. That's the truck loading spaces in commercial facilities. There are a couple other miscellaneous minor policy amendments related to small lots in the R5 zone, bicycle parking, accessory dwelling units, and then, as I mentioned, a whole slew of what we'd classify as technical corrections, or not quite typos, but just above a typo level. The green bundle that I talked about, the purpose is to remove regulatory barriers for installing green technologies and create standards tailored to the potential impacts. So by green technologies, I mean things like solar panels, green roofs, building eaves, small urban wind turbines, district-based or local energy systems, water collection cisterns. And so we're looking for places in the zoning code where there's potential conflict with further adoption of these technologies. And one of the themes you'll hear about is a number of these recommended exemptions or amendments to the code deal with design and historic design review in some of those districts of the city. One of the amendments deals with solar panels and how you deal with building height if the building is already up to the height limit and somebody wants to add a rack system to a roof. Another section provides a prescriptive path for solar panels in conservation and historic districts and just in design overlay zones generally. It does not allow them outright without some standards, but it provides a pathway as an alternative to design review. A new set of regulations for the size, height, and impacts of small wind turbines in an urban area, and the screen shows some examples of that. We're not talking about the large industrial turbines that you might see in the eastern Oregon, but more of a small scale, often building mounted systems. This slide I threw in just to acknowledge that this is evolving technology, and it shows a couple different innovative emerging technologies about how solar panels are often being integrated into building materials themselves. And so this is no doubt going to keep us thinking as we go on through the next few years, and we're going to have to probably further adapt our codes as new ideas come online. The RECAP 5 bundle attempts to incorporate what we know today. Deals with water cisterns and green roofs, both important for controlling stormwater impacts in urban areas, increasingly a part of kind of standard building construction, but can have impacts if not done well. One cluster of amendments here looks at how energy is produced. And if you look back historically, zoning codes considered the production of energy to be an industrial use. If you were making energy, you were an industrial facility. And obviously, when you think about solar panels today or other kinds of small systems that produce power from the environmental conditions of a site, like small wind or heat exchangers or biogas generators that may use restaurant waste or things like that are byproducts of a use that's otherwise allowed on the site. RECAP 5 attempts to rethink the use categories around energy production and get to a point where we can allow more distributed energy systems in our urban neighborhoods. One of the amendments here that you may hear testimony about deals with building eaves. And the current code allows, and this is the zoning code, allows building eaves to project a certain percentage into the side setbacks. And right now that basically means that you can have a 1 foot eave on most buildings, given what the setbacks are. And we're proposing to amend that to basically allow a 2 foot eave. The benefits of that have to do with better protecting the building, given the weather that we have in Portland. And also in the summer, it tends to shade the building better, which helps with the energy required to cool buildings in the summer. Another amendment in this package, or another cluster of amendments, deals with follow-up, as I said, to the courtyard housing contest. And what that contest focused on was finding innovative designs for housing that's clustered around a common largely shared open space or courtyard kind of configuration. And this is seen as a way to further encourage or make family-friendly housing at higher densities than we've seen in the past, where we can really make sure there's adequate open space and share that open space. In that contest, after holding the contest, we examined the winning designs and kind of did a code audit with them. When we have architectural contests, we rarely require the applicants in the contest to meet every letter of building codes because we're trying to stimulate innovation. But after the fact, we did look and see, well, what codes would the winners run afoul of, and should we change any of those? And we came up with a list of a few changes. One of the lessons we learned is that the medium density zones that this contest was targeted for, there's a couple different zoning designations, and we found that many of the winning designs had a density that was above the maximum of one zone but below the minimum of the next zone up. And so it was kind of it appeared to be a sweet spot in design that our code wasn't really permitting because our zoning densities didn't meet and didn't provide that allowance. And so we're proposing to amend the density regulations for courtyard housing to close that gap and allow a greater range of flexibility of densities if you're doing courtyard housing. That also resolves some conflicts in the code where you have different densities in the current code if you're doing a condominium versus a land division, and we wanted to make that so there wasn't that oddity. Another aspect of the contest was a lot of the entries were fairly creative in how they integrated vehicle parking into a courtyard environment, and we wanted to clarify some of the parking rules about if you're on a site that requires off-street parking, just clarifying that it is allowed to configure that parking in shared areas rather than each house having to have its own garage if that was the preferred style. Another lesson from this contest was that you want to have a lot of interaction or the design of the interface between the buildings and the courtyard is important, and a lot of the winning designs had balconies and bay windows and trellises that kind of blurred the boundary between someone's living room and the shared outdoor space, just so it wasn't such a stark boundary. And the current code setback requirements were discouraging some of those features, and so we looked at carving out some additional exceptions for the bay windows and porches and balconies that face those common shared areas. We also looked at structures within the shared open space areas. A lot of the designs included things like gazebos or small play structures or small, I guess what you'd call tea houses or a gathering building for the community. And so within limits, we wanted to allow for that more specifically within the zoning code. A different amendment here. We looked at, as part of Recap 5, some conflicts in the fence height regulations that the city has. And the current code requires or has fence height limits for the front lot line of lots. But the way the code defines what the front lot line is doesn't always jibe with where your front door is. And so we had some disconnects we were seeing between where the low fence had to be and where we really wanted the visibility. And so this amendment clarifies that and allows the lower fence to be actually on the lot line where the main entry is. We also resolved some conflicts in the commercial and employment industrial zones. The current code basically says that you have to have the lower fence in your front setback area, but some of those zones don't have front setbacks. In other words, we allow the building right up to the street. And so that was a loophole that was allowing 8-foot fences along the sidewalk of commercial streets, even though the building with windows was right behind that fence. And so this amendment clarifies that even if you don't have a front setback, if you do have a building there and you have a what essentially is a front yard, that you still have to do the lower fence on the front property line facing the street. And just for the audience, one of the reasons we're concerned about the lower fences is just security and eyes on the street and making sure that the public right-of-way isn't walled off from the private property. Another amendment relates to truck loading spaces. The current zoning code has one threshold for when a truck loading space is required, and it generally applies to larger residential projects or if you have commercial uses on the site. And so what's been happening is that for infill mixed-use buildings where they might have mostly residential but maybe a small coffee shop on the first floor, a lot of those kind of projects have had to go through an exception process in the zoning code to not have the loading space. And so what we've proposed is to establish a slightly different threshold for when those loading spaces are required, and then also provide a second smaller loading space as an option on some sites. Bicycle parking was an issue that wasn't originally part of RECAP, but came up in many of the public hearings as an issue that really needed to be dealt with. And so the Planning Commission asked us to take it on. And what it does two things. One is that currently the zoning code, and this is about long-term bike parking. So by that, I mean where you park your bike, where you sleep at night, or when you're at work. It's as distinct from maybe if you're visiting a store and you need to park your bike just for a few minutes. So for long-term bike parking, the current zoning code provided an exception for residential buildings where it said that if you were going to allow bikes to be parked in the units, you didn't have to provide long-term bike parking in a formal way as in a rack or a specific place. But what we've been seeing happening is that the developer will say that, but then when we look at the lease agreements that are in that building later, they're not allowing the bike parking. So it's become kind of an enforcement problem, and we are hearing complaints from condominium residents that there isn't adequate bike parking. And so we're going to close that loophole, and what this does is require in all cases that there be long-term bike parking, and that can be provided in a shared common room, or it could be that each apartment would clearly have a place that was designated.
Would this apply to all multi-unit housing, regardless of whether it was public or private?
Yes, this would be a zoning requirement.
And it would be, so it would apply to affordable housing?
Yeah, there wouldn't be an affordability test. It's housing, residential uses. There is a threshold. My understanding is that it doesn't apply to duplexes and single dwelling homes because they don't have to, there's no parking requirement for them. The other change that the Planning Commission recommended was that we increase the number of bike parking spaces. The current code requires one parking space for every four dwelling units. And we heard a lot of testimony from condominium associations that wasn't adequate and that they were having at their own expense to have to retrofit their buildings to increase the number of bike parking spaces in response to demand, and that they asked us to consider increasing that. The Planning Commission recommended a ratio of 1.1, which is just slightly above one parking space per unit.
What was the rationale for the 1.1?
They discussed that, and actually Chris Smith is here from the Planning Commission, I think, to tell you a little bit more about that conversation. Basically, it had to do with looking at how many bikes do Portlanders typically own, and based on our experience, what that means for a number of the parking spaces that we need. Another issue that came up in the Planning Commission discussion was testimony about accessory dwelling units. And right now, the accessory dwelling units, or in other words, granny flats or secondary units, backyard cottages is another term people use for them. Right now, the code requires that they meet two tests. One is that they be no more than 33% the size of the main house, and the other is they have an absolute maximum of 800 square feet. The problem with that test is that if you already have a really small house, you're going to be held to that 33% standard, and your accessory dwelling unit is going to be really, really small. And so the request came from people who have been building ADUs and running into problems with providing them on lots with small houses already. And so by increasing the percentage, we're not increasing most ADUs because they're still held to the 800 square feet, but we are allowing more of them on sites where there already are small houses. Another item I want to walk through in a little detail is the code standards related to the R5 zone and the small pre-existing lots in that zone. This received quite a bit of testimony at the Planning Commission. What we're talking about here is parts of town where there are
historic old plats of lots that are 25 by 100, and those plats underlie an existing ownership pattern that looks a little bit different than that. And I'll talk about that in a little more detail. This is a map just showing the yellow and orange are the R5 and R2.5 zones where this occurs. And then the purple is the areas with these underlying plats that really have the historic sort of grandfathering rights to a higher density of development. So here's a little more descriptive picture of what's happening here. As you often have a situation where historically the area was developed and platted with 25 by 100 lots, but what happened is people bought units of two or three of them and then built a house. And so you might have somebody who's got a house that straddles two or three of these existing lots. But based on state law, if that house goes away, they have some level of rights to redevelop those lots separately. And so over the years, we've had a lot of issues with this, and this is what led to the, as all of you know, I'm sure, the Living Smart design contest, and there's a whole section of the zoning code that deals with building design on these lots. What we focused on primarily in this discussion was not about as much about the design, but more about what is the process of acknowledging and verifying whether these lots have those grandfathering rights, and under what circumstances can they be built on. One of the things we proposed is just to be clear that if you have a whole one of these lots, and there isn't a house on it, that is buildable. And so there's not clear standards on what size requirements exist for those lots, but this would clarify that if you have that whole pre-existing lot and there's no existing house, that is clearly a situation where that's allowed. Another set of amendments deals with, was aimed at corner situations, and what we tried to do was create a second size standard that allows if you have a wider frontage to allow a smaller lot size. And what that really means if you zoom into that corner lot is the current situation is on the left, and because the current code requires you to have equally sized lots on that corner, often what happens if you go back to this situation is if you're on that corner, it might be in your interest to take that pre-existing lot line and swivel it at a right angle to make that backyard into a separate lot through a property line adjustment. And what people are currently doing is resulting in these somewhat odd-shaped lots, which are shown on the left, where you've got somebody's lot line kind of encroaching into what looks kind of like the front yard of the neighboring house just to meet the letter of the code. And what we're proposing is a little more flexibility here so that we can get a square lot shape in that situation. And this was part of an overall discussion of how do we make clear these codes, and in doing so, we're going to be a little more restrictive on some of these lots and a little more liberal on others. And this is one of the examples where the stakeholder committee that we had looking at this thought, some of them thought that it might be okay to allow more liberal lot sizes on the corner, because what that does is it encourages the lots with the wider frontage. And for neighborhoods that are concerned about skinny houses, this was an issue or a way to deal with that.
So, excuse me, Doug, so does that mean, I was just looking at the numbers in the last diagram, that would allow for a lot as small as 900 square feet?
No, it 1,600 would be the minimum.
Okay, I was going 36 feet by 25, or is that 225?
225, so it's okay. 36 by 50.
Gotcha, okay.
And it's true that this isn't specifically in the code written so that it only applies to corner lots, but primarily that's where you would be able to reach the 36-foot wide provision. If you weren't on a corner, there's fewer situations where you could actually find that 36 feet. Another situation that we wanted to clarify is that the current code, and this was the result of the council's compromise with the skinny house issues and the Living Smart contest, is that there's currently a 5-year waiting period if you do demolish any existing house before you can build on these independent lots. And that was designed to discourage demolition and you know, preserve existing perfectly good housing. What we saw when the economy was really heated up is that a lot of people were perfectly willing to wait that 5 years. And so we were seeing demolition happening. But then we got other complaints from neighborhood associations that there was just vacant, unkept property waiting for that 5-year period. And so in discussing this with some neighborhood representatives, the feeling was that there may be an interest in having some other pathway. If the house is already down, is there a way to allow some development? And we discussed an allowance for if you go through design review, that you would be able to go beyond that waiting period.
Could you explain that? What would the design review criteria be in neighborhoods?
The criteria is the, I believe, I'm going to look to staff, it's the community design standards or
so it's not design
guidelines.
Review. It's just pick out of the list of...
No, it would be standards. Design review. I'm sorry, I misspoke. It's the community design guidelines, which are the discretionary pieces. So it would be through a discretionary review with public notice.
I thought we weren't allowed to do design review outside of the central city.
We are not allowed to do design review as a mandate, but we can tie it to... bonuses and special provisions like this where we're giving something in exchange for it.
And do the community design guidelines apply to this kind of situation? Have we reviewed them in terms of the suitability for getting the kind of design that we want?
Yes. I mean, a lot of them deal with the orientation of the building to the street, and one of the big issues is on the narrow houses is how is the parking in the front yard handled, and we think that those guidelines do get at that issue. Finally, another focus in this cluster of amendments was, in some cases, it's not clear-cut, and we have what we call these odd slivers of deeded property that have some, you know, complex history of deeds, and we can't always figure out whether that was once an independent lot or whether it represents essentially some transfer of property in the past that's kind of preserved, fossilized in the property line records, if you will. And so this... some of the language in this code amendment deals with defining, creating a definition for what essentially is a sliver of land that we can't figure out what it is, and some provisions for how we resolve those conflicts. We've had a lot of conflicts in the Development Services Center about these kind of situations and whether they are really historic lots or something else. So we created a definition for what we're calling an adjusted lot and a lot remnant, which are sort of different parts of those kind of historic transactions of property, and we can then, by having a definition, we can describe when it's okay to consider that a lot or not. And this is kind of on the margins because it's not a lot of lots that this applies to, but when it happens, it leads to a lot of argument and eats up a lot of time in with BDS staff. We are not amending standards or not recommending amending standards related to garages on the fronts of the narrow houses. This was something that was discussed at the Planning Commission, and the Commission recommended against proceeding with an amendment at this time. They did express a sentiment that the City Council consider funding and directing further design work related to narrow houses, but they didn't feel that RECAP was the place to propose those amendments at this time. So that's my overview of some of the major items on this package. The Planning Commission's recommendation was... that you adopt the RECAP 5 recommended draft, that you amend the zoning code and the maps accordingly. And then, as I said, they asked you that you direct further work on some of the narrow house issues. I'm going to ask Chris Smith to come up for a moment just to say a few words on behalf of the commission as well.
Welcome, Chris.
Thank you. I understand that this morning you extended my term and those of several of my colleagues. I appreciate that.
It was a close vote, but we were happy to do it. I believe that Commissioner Leonard's speech carried the day.
I called it a sentence, not an extension.
So Planning Commission does recommend this package to you. There are a number of areas that were non-controversial, but that we support very much, including the Green Bundle. Probably the main point there that we heard testimony about was the extension of eaves into the setback, and we heard concerns about light and air. Staff did a shadow study to look at that and satisfy the commission's concerns. I'm not sure we satisfied the citizens' concerns that testified about that. We also very much support the adjustments for the small lots that Eric just talked about, along with the courtyard amendments to make those designs really possible. The areas that we weighed in on, first to remove the regulation of garages on the front of some skinny houses. As you know, RECAP is at least in part a suggestion-driven process, and that came from a community suggestion. But as we got into the process, there was very little testimony from the folks supporting that and a lot of testimony from the infill developers that this was not helpful to them and their market or the right time in the economy to be making those choices. Don't know that I personally agree with that, but we didn't think now was the time to make that adjustment, and we do recommend that you put in the BPS work plan to spend more time studying that so we can have a broader process with more outreach to get more perspectives on that. Another area where we weighed in was the ADUs. We heard testimony that the 33% limitation was restricting ADU development, and really to us this came down to a trade-off of enabling ADUs, which of course are important for our infill goals and sustainability, as well as providing affordable housing, since ADUs are typically a very affordable type of housing, versus the design issue of preserving the, I think we coined the word subsidiariness of the accessory unit to the main dwelling. So, you know, essentially we came down on the position of allowing ADUs that are closer to the size of the main unit in the interest of making ADUs more practical in some cases. And then the final issue I want to talk about is the bike parking ratio, since it's a little bit complex and I helped get to that 1.1 number. So the derivation of the 1.1 number is the average occupancy of multi-dwelling units is 1.6 people. The bicycle ownership rate in Portland is 70%. That is 70% of individuals own a bicycle. So if you multiply 1.6 by 70%, you get 1.1. So essentially that says that on average we're accommodating one bicycle for everyone who owns one. Now, of course, that's an average across the city where we have many different factors, and we know that that is a very broad brush. We got there because the current standard is 0.25. Testimony established that it's clearly inadequate. I think we all know that in the city where 6 to 8% of people are using bicycles as a regular mode of transportation, that 0.25 is unlikely to be, you know, a sustainable number. And in fact, the 1996 Bicycle Master Plan recommended 1.0. So we've been deficient from our goal for a long time. So we did want to address it immediately. We know that this number is just a stab, but we think it's important to bring it up to a more realistic number. When you get our recommendation on the Bicycle Master Plan, you will see that we're recommending that as part of the Portland plan, we spend some time looking at parking in general, both motor vehicle parking and bicycle parking, how we allocate space to both of those and how those get traded off as we see the bicycle mode split continue to rise over time. So we talked about numbers anywhere between 1.0 and 1.5, and I suspect you'll hear some testimony for the 1.5 number today. There are some good arguments for that. There are also some issues. There's a sweet spot beyond which, up to which you can accommodate additional bike parking in the garage areas of typical multi-dwelling units, and that's somewhere around the 1.0, 1.1. If you go beyond that, then one of two things is going to happen. Either the developer is going to need to increase the building's footprint in order to accommodate more bicycle parking, and of course that's opposite our sustainability directions, or they're simply going to opt for the in-unit storage, so they put a couple of bike racks in the unit itself, and people would be taking their bicycles up in the elevator and hanging them in their units, and that was probably the answer for affordable housing. Commissioner Fish, is the cheapest way to do this is to put some hooks in the unit. Obviously there are disadvantages to that, but if you're trying to keep the cost down, that's the way to do it. So without doing more work to establish what are the right standards and the right circumstances and right parts of the city, we felt like 1.1 was a good compromise number as an initial attempt to get out of the clearly inadequate space that we're in now.
Chris, could I just ask you a follow-up question on that? Because how does the incidence of bike ownership change as you get older along the spectrum? So among, let's say, people 55 and older, did the numbers change much?
Yes, they own two bikes older than 55.
Right. I think the correct answer is we don't have that data, so that's part of what we need to establish. But I think you would see in different circumstances you get different patterns. So the couple that sells their house and moves into a condo may very well get a couple bicycles to ride around the Pearl District, you know, to go to the grocery store or whatever. So I wouldn't want to say that there's, you know, a one-size-fits-all answer to that. And it's an area that needs more study.
And so I thought one of part of the reason for this change was the concern that people were not allowed to carry their bikes up to their room. So how would putting the racks in the units apply?
Right. So, that's the rationale to not jump to 1.5, because 1.5 would start to capture things like people who own two bicycles and having room for that.
No, my concern is that we heard that the condo developers don't let people put their bikes in their room.
I guess our theory is that if there is a rack there, that they might have a harder time arguing that there should be a rule against bringing your bike up.
Pretty hard to make a condo association bylaw that you can't bring bikes in the elevator if you've just built two racks into the wall of the unit. But at least I believe, having worked with some developers who've kind of looked at how they would fit in more bicycle parking, is that if we don't go beyond 1.0, 1.1, we're likely to fit them all into the garage areas. If we put pressure on beyond that, they're going to find that putting it in the unit and not having that condo bylaw is going to be a more attractive solution. What I'd really like to see happen, again, it's my personal opinion, in the Portland plan, we should revisit both this ratio and parking maximums. Because really, if you look at our city, if you look at Amsterdam and Copenhagen, we go over and visit, and we find it kind of charming that there are bicycles stacked everywhere. The residents of those cities find that very annoying. So the good news here in Portland is we have lots of space available for parking because we've given it aside for parking cars. As we become less reliant on cars and more reliant on bicycles, we should shift some of that space from cars to bikes. We need to be conscious about how we make that shift, and that's what we should look at in the Portland plan. So I don't want to add more space for bikes without removing some space for cars, because then we have bigger building footprints or other behavior that's not in a positive direction. So that's picking 1.1. We're trying to go as far as we can without triggering what I think are some risks that we might not want to deal with without more knowledge. So with that, my colleagues and I recommend this package to you, recommend that you put in the BPS work plan further work on the garage issue on skinny houses. Thank you.
Question. I apologize. Mm-hmm. We need to step out to make a quick phone call. The notion of doing the ratio of 1.5 to 1 in an area of town like the central city, did you cover that? That is a potential?
Well, what I covered is that we believe that we probably should have different ratios for different circumstances. We don't know enough to know what the right ones are. I think we can safely say that in the central city that a higher ratio is probably supportable. Again, the concern that if we don't reduce auto parking at the same time, we may expand building footprints, which is an effect that we probably don't want.
So one thing I'd ask the city council to consider is that we make an amendment to provide for that, knowing that the Portland plan will be coming along soon and considering it therefore a pilot mm-hmm. in the intervening time.
I'm certainly very supportive of bicycle parking.
Thank you. Where are we, Mr. President?
I ruled Commissioner Leonard out of order twice.
And a lot of good that did, Jeff.
And beyond that, I think we're ready to go to 8 members of the public to testify.
All right. Did
you want me to mention the amendments that I would like to consider? Or?
I think now's a good time, yeah. So that citizen testimony might speak to them.
So I'll just mention generally, because I don't have specific language at this point for most of them, but I do want the citizens to have the opportunity to testify on some of the things that I noticed in the package, which, as usual, has been done very well by staff. The first item is on water cisterns, the question of whether we should allow them in the front yard, and if so, whether they should be screened, and also the colors. There's currently a specification for the color. I think we saw in the Bureau of Planning presentation that beautiful one with the flowers on it, which I would hope that we would allow things like that. So it doesn't seem to me that the color is particularly important. Then there's a density gap between the R1 and the R2, as Eric mentioned. But we're lowering the density in R2 as well as in R1, and there wasn't a rationale for that in the package. So I would want to know from citizens whether you support decreased density in the R2 zone. There's an ADU's density calculation which takes out the sentence that says that accessory dwelling units are not counted in the density. It seems to me that's a helpful thing that people should know that, because we want more accessory dwelling units built. Loading space triggers. I know from the Buckman neighborhood that there's been a lot of concern about there being enough space for loading for commercial and domestic uses, so I'm interested to hear about that. disturbance areas and environmental zones. There seems to be some confusion between private and public disturbance areas. Fencing on corner lots, which again was in the presentation, concern about there being the potential for 8-foot fences along the pedestrian sidewalk on major streets if the house is oriented to the side street. That may be a bit more, give more privacy to the home, but it also creates an unfriendly pedestrian environment. Just a minor detail to add that comprehensive plan map amendments come to the City Council. Right-of-way dedications, there's a minor amendment to change what to clarify what a building lot line is, or that we're talking about the building and the lot line. Solar panels and schools, currently the proposal says that we can have ground-based solar panels in school sites. It seems to me we should add an exemption for rooftop solar panels by right without having to go through conditional uses. I have questions on the transportation planning rule and the way that zone changes in compliance with the comprehensive plan are done. So to make sure that the developer is responsible for doing the transportation improvements. Then there's a whole set of amendments on skinny lots in the R5 zone, which it seems to me that over time we decided to allow R2.5 level development in the R5 zone in areas that had historic platting of lots. Each time we've done that, or we've done an amendment to it, we get more and more convoluted in our regulations as to what's allowed and what's not, and then sooner or later, each time we have to come back and do something else. I would like us to recommend that this be covered in the Portland plan and that we should look at which areas are suitable for R2.5 development and which areas should remain R5. So there's a there's a few changes in that. I think that in the lots where there's the gerrymandering of lot lines, I'd be interested to hear why it was not feasible to just not allow that, and what the unintended consequences might have been. But in particular, there's a proposed change in the West Portland Park neighborhood, which happens to be my neighborhood, where back in 1979, the skinny lot issue came up and the neighborhood appealed to LUBA and got regulations that don't allow skinny lot development in R5. In the Southwest Community Plan, the Neighborhood Association and the Bureau of Planning discussed where would be appropriate for R2.5, and we rezoned a strip of land, R2.5. It was never intended that that land that's now appropriately zoned at R2.5 would have to abide by skinny lot regulations. And so although I don't believe there was any outreach to the West Portland Park Neighborhood Association on this particular issue, my feeling as a former land use chair on that issue is that R2.5 means R2.5. That was what the zoning was requested, and that eventually I'd like to get back to seeing R5 being R5. There's some language changes on the non-conforming upgrades that we should allow some leeway in terms of the amount of development that's allowed to not count towards other requirements in terms of non-conforming development upgrades, but others should not be. The eaves into the setback is of great concern to me because I think we're still not getting the kind of development that fits into neighborhoods. We have very large houses on small lots that the eave projection doesn't really address the problem of proper light and air into the houses and space between the houses. And then finally, the issue of wind turbines and just making sure that neighbors had a good discussion of the proposal to have wind turbines be allowed by right in all zones.
I have a few. One is to come back to us with a proposal on the 1.5 in the central city, give us a boundary on that. The other is contained in a January 5th, 2010 memo to the City Council, amendments to recap 5, mostly technical in nature, dealing with rotor sweep area height testing related to the micro wind turbines, and then the changes to 33.420.045 regarding design review and micro wind turbines. I think you have copies of these.
Yes, and staff is prepared to go through the list that Commissioner Fritz provided. I'm assuming we do that after public testimony, or?
Yep. All right. Or next time. Carla, we'll probably do it next time, so we take our time.
The first three, please come on up, are Kathy Goldberg, Betsy Brum, and Michelle Poyoro. They'll be followed by Andrew Konatsky, Bonnie McKnight, and Eli Spivak.
Good afternoon. Welcome back. I think for all of you, at least a couple times.
Long time.
Betsy, would you like to go first?
Well, she's going to pass out some pictures that I think will tell you why I'm here. I'll hold this up. This is what, when I get up in the morning, excuse me, Mayor Adams, commissioners, I'm Betsy Brum. I live at 2830 Northeast Regents Drive, Portland, Oregon, 97212. When I get up in the morning and go out to my to pick up my newspaper, which I may cancel because of this, this is what I see, which is, I think you've received an email in a packet with pictures from Mark and Annette Benedelli, who live near me. However, I understand your firewall did not let the pictures through. I have tons of them in my cell phone, so I thought I would just blow one up for you. I want to ask the council to redefine what a retaining wall is, and also to have a setback at the ground level of more than 2 feet. By the way, this one has 2 feet on one end and 1 foot, 11 and a half inches on the other. So if you'd like to have it torn down, it would be fine with me. And make some attempt to have, as Washington County does and several other places, that you have a retaining wall that goes up 6-7 feet, and then you have a setback. There's no way that there's going to be able to have vegetation. This is going to be a great graffiti wall. It's 50 feet long by 12 feet high. And there was nothing we could do about it because the city had already given the permit to have that done. It was under the auspices that they wanted a safe place for their children to play. I have another picture that shows that they're going to have some artificial grass somewhere in this lot. And I'm not actually quite sure where it is going to be. What we have now is a 50, okay, I did that. Some of you might remember Dorothea Lynch, and if I see anybody nod, then you're as old as I am, or close. Dorothea Lynch was the first actual person who set and made limits for having public parks in Portland, even though we had them, but make sure that there were green spaces for every neighborhood. She worked under the Goldschmidt administration and did a great job, and we would not have the Japanese Garden if it were not for Dorothea Lynch, and in her later years, she served tea there every Sunday. This is the house that she was born in. It was her parents' house. It's directly across the street from me. I knew her my whole life. There were 6 truckloads of cement that came in to fill that wall and to fill the back part of their, whatever it is they've done. And then I understand I was actually out of town, but there were also 2 days worth of huge rocks dropped in behind the wall. So I'm asking that the city council look at a setback and for some vegetation for any walls to be built before you do that again. They were given the original permit under that auspices that they would their children would play with there. I look out at that wall, but what I really would like to do is, because on top of that wall originally was to be a 6-foot solid wood fence. Sheila Fregoli, and I hope I'm saying that correctly, did a great job in working with those of us who live in the neighborhood. So that got reduced down to a 4-foot fence. I asked to have it be a 3.5, which is what the law says. But Sheila did a great job. We only had 29, I believe, neighborhood people. I could have gotten 1,000 people to sign. I didn't do that. Thank you for your time and consideration.
Thank you, Betsy. Michelle?
Good afternoon, mayors and mayor and commissioners. My name is Michelle Poyoro. I'm an advocate with the Bicycle Transportation Alliance, and I'm here to speak in support of the increase in the long-term bicycle parking minimums required in the city of Portland. I became interested in this issue a number of years ago because I was fielding so many phone calls from 2 groups of people. On the one hand, representatives of condo and homeowners associations who, as Chris described, were struggling to retrofit their buildings and pay to retrofit their buildings and also architecturally retrofit their buildings to accommodate all these bicycles. And I could hear them banging their heads and thinking, why wasn't this just done right? We would have been happy to pay for it when we bought our units, but now they had to deal with it. The other group of people we heard from was renters who unfortunately weren't as organized and didn't have really a way to raise revenue to make these retrofits. So they were really just calling us to ask if there was anyone else they could call to get their landlord to install some bike parking. So we realized that there was a problem in the ability of people to store bicycles in multi-dwelling buildings in this city. And for us, that became obvious to us, was a real barrier to using a bicycle. I don't know about you, but I cannot really even lift my bike over my doorway, much less get it through my house and onto a balcony or upstairs. And of course, if you go around the city and you look at apartments, you'll see bikes on balconies all over the place. So being able to drag that thing off and hop on it for a short trip is certainly not as easy as if it's just parked outside your door or in the garage. So the Bicycle Transportation Alliance is interested in reducing barriers to bicycling so that people can make that choice easily when they want to. So we support the increase to 1.1 spaces per unit. We did also propose to the Planning Commission that they consider a districted approach, which, Mayor, is similar to what you've suggested, in which in some districts of the city where we know that more people own and ride bicycles, or even want to encourage more so people to own and ride bicycles, that the requirement be higher, and in other parts of the city it be lower. So to that end, we would support 1.5 in the central city and 1.0 elsewhere. I'm also very interested to see how this plays out. Buildings is very hard, and banks have various requirements. So whatever you pass, I'm going to be watching and talking to Bureau of Development Services and to developers to find out what these new requirements actually look like on the ground. And if there's something to be tweaked there, I'd be excited to talk about that again in the context of the Portland plan. So thank you very much. I really appreciate the work the Planning Bureau has done on this as part of RECAP, and I appreciate the opportunity to talk to you about it today. Thanks.
Thank you, Michelle.
Good afternoon. I'm Kathy Galbraith from the Bosco Milligan Foundation, 701 Southeast Grand Avenue. I came for reassurance that I've received in looking at the handouts about the design review requirements for designated landmark buildings and solar issues in historic districts. So my concerns about those, I think, have satisfied the Landmarks Commission and those of us from the public that spend time at Landmarks working on the review of RECAP. The second issue that I'm concerned about is the one that was raised in an email that was sent to you from Doug Klotz, who's a resident of the Richmond neighborhood, and he expressed concern about the provision to allow the encroachment of roof eaves into 40% of the required setbacks on houses. And he made a pretty strong case for a 13% resulting reduction in daylight, which will lead to people turning on their lights earlier, reduction in shade, and the additional infiltration of water from the encroaching eaves into those setbacks. I had read the city's earlier shallow analysis that was referenced in the staff presentation, and I thought it sounded fine. But after looking at Mr. Klotz's analysis, he makes a really good point. With a potential legal lot width of only 25 feet, or 36 feet, you've got really narrow side yard setbacks in any case, and encroaching into those required setbacks with the eaves is going to create fairly apparent problems when you look at his shadow analysis. You know, my Portland house is on a lot that's 38 feet in width. The houses all predate zoning. The setbacks are minimal. They're 3 feet on either side. You can hear toilets flush when the windows are open, just like we all do in dense living. But some of those roof eaves already shed water into neighboring basements, including mine. And if we're for new development that's going to be built with even greater encroachment of eaves into those setbacks, we're going to wind up with substantial additional water infiltration problems. To me, the 300-pound gorilla issue on the issue of solar access, and I know it's beyond RECAP 5, is one we haven't addressed, and that's how are we going to get a handle on the potential so-called infill new development that's going to result in blocking any solar access for adjacent smaller houses. And I think that's an issue that we haven't addressed yet as a city, but I think those conflicts are coming. I think that the RECAP, the whole package is ambitious. It's very detailed. A lot of people put in just scores of hours on all of this stuff. And I think we'll see regulations of this scope present unintended consequences as time goes on. And we'll probably be revisiting this in a few years to see what results from the scope of these regulations. Thank you, and Happy New Year.
Happy New Year to you. Thank you all. Carla, the next three.
The next three are Andrew Koyanisquatsi, Eli Spivak, and Gwen Milius.
Good afternoon. Welcome to Council Chambers. We're glad you're here. You just have to give us your first and last name, and the clock will help you count down 3 minutes. Go ahead.
Okay. My name is Andrew, and I'm the owner of Solar Energy Solutions. And first thing I want to do is say bravo for even talking about solar. I've been installing solar in Portland for 22 years, and the change that's coming about is just wonderful. I used to go into the city and get a building permit for solar, and I'd have to wait for the laughter to die down before I could even take it to the next level. So I'm here to tell you that things have come a long way, and once again, bravo. But, you know, there is, it seems to me, from my own personal experience with getting a permit, is that there are still individuals, despite the mayor's will or the city council's will, who are not really, they're still old school and still hard to deal with them. And I just encourage you to continue asserting your solar will, and hopefully that will seep down to the administrators of the permitting process even better. I have some concerns about the proposed solar on historic buildings. The 3-foot setback just doesn't make sense to me because, you know, I think it all looks beautiful everywhere. I do believe there are more pretty installations than less and less pretty installations. But I think that as long as the solar installation stays within the framework of a roofing structure, that is fine. And that by having 3 feet off, that's only going to reduce the number of solar installations occur in these neighborhoods and reduce the size of systems. So that 3 foot, just if it's just based upon aesthetics, it doesn't really make sense to me because it's not going to make solar look any pretty. It's just going to, you know, reduce the available. And this takes out all of Ladd's Addition, which is where our target market is. There are environmentally thoughtful and somewhat affluent individuals, and so you're basically taking out of the market that whole neighborhood, unless they go through this long review process. And the other comment I have is that I'd like to encourage City Council and the mayor to be even more aggressive advocates for solar energy. And consider the idea of having code where all new houses are required to have solar, or if commercial buildings should be required to have solar, or at least they have their industrial section in one corner, so that way they're solar friendly. Hawaii has just enacted a law requiring all new homes to have solar systems on them. So it's, even though it sounds crazy, it's been done before. And then finally, I'd like to encourage you to help with a statewide solar code, which is in dire need.
Thank you for your comments very much, sir.
Hello, my name is Eli Spivak. I'm at 6325 North Albina, Unit 6 in Portland, North Portland. I'm a developer, general contractor, building small communities of small homes through my company, Orange Splot LLC. And I've interested in a lot of the issues in this package, but most particularly I'm interested in accessory dwelling units, small homes. There's just a study by DEQ showing that of all the variety of a 20 or some odd measures people might do to make a house have a smaller footprint, including, you know, job site waste management, good solar systems, weatherization, the best thing you can do is just make them a little bit smaller, like 2,100 square feet to 1,700 square feet. Makes a difference that trumps the other ones. And accessory dwelling units are a lot smaller than that, but almost none of them get built. They meet a lot of city housing goals, small energy-efficient homes. They're neighborhood-friendly infill development. They're affordable, and they let people innovate with different types of homes. The first net-zero house in the city was ADU. So I don't need to say about the great things about them, except that there have been 20 or so built every year in the past few years, even before the housing crash in construction. They were down to like 16 a year and dropping down below that. And so I've been part of a group to try and figure out why. And one of those is addressed in this recap five, is that there's currently a size requirement that can't be more than one-third the size of the primary dwelling or 800 square feet, whatever's less. Well, if you have a 1,500 square foot house and there are plenty of them that size or smaller in Portland, it kind of eliminates the possibility of doing an ADU. Or if you're going to, it has to go through a adjustment process, which the city's never denied, but it costs money and takes time and has risk. So I'm glad that RECAP includes a provision which changes that 33% to 75%, and I'm hopeful that the city takes some additional steps to try and figure out how to get more of these built. Other obstacles to building ADUs are the SDC fees, which are a little bit lower, but not much lower than for a primary house. They're in like the $10,000 to $13,000 range. For a tiny house, that's hard to do. Design requirements, I think that it's appropriate to have design because it's infill lots, but currently you have to match the design of the existing house. So if the existing house is T111 siding with no eaves, you have to match it or get an appeal. So existing house looks like crap,